This is tape number two, side one, of the interview with Dewey Tippett on April 24th, 1994. Now, when we finished on the end of the first tape, you were talking about the older system of having lights in the shaft.
No, they weren't lights in the shaft. They weren't lights in the shaft. They were called shaft lights. They were located on the main line, main level, at each cross with a train went to shaft, they would turn on the red light, referred to as a shaft light, and that indicated that there was a motor at shaft, and they would have to wait until the motor came back in from shaft. Those lights weren't at shaft, they were inside. And as the motor came in from shaft, the motorman to turn the light on is the motorman to turn the light off. So that somebody else that was a violation of the rule for somebody else to turn the shaft light off. If when the motor that went out shaft, turned it on, and he's the one that would turn it off, and then they would know that there was clear to go back to somebody else to go to shaft when the light was out.
Can you run through for me, you've established that you might have 1208 going to 1208. Tell me exactly what you would say to the motorman on that motor and what he exactly would say back to you. Did you have standard things that you would say to each other so that they knew the communication was over, and how would that go?
Well, when the motor says if 1208 motor would be out in the what they call the yard area where the empty cars were kept after they came through the dump. He would call in and he would identify himself as they call in 1208. And he'd say, ready to go in. So then, okay, we'll just tell him, well, if the main line was clear, if there was more trains coming to shaft, well, if you tell him, well, just tell him, 1208, just hold up in the yard. And then after the main line was clear, then you tell him, call 1208, and he would answer you by his number, and then you would, we would tell him, okay, you can go into 1208 Coscott, or go to 1209 Coscott, go into the whatever chute number that you assign him to, and tell him that there's such and such a chute as a main of those place in the world where transfer points where you, instead of loading directly into these cars from the rays, but in this system it's kind of went down to had a transfer on the, what was it called, a top timber. It was one drift immediately above the other that would be off of the crosscut, and then the dirt would be stored up in there. The scraperman could scrape continuously. If the train was gone out the shaft, bank up dirt, he would keep scraping up and keep banking it up in there. As soon as the train came in, then he could start loading the train. When he had banked up, if he had enough to fill a train, okay. If he didn't, well, he'd take what was there and just send him to another chute. But it was all, you never referred to a motor by the motorman's name. You referred to it as always as a number, a locomotive number. That way there's no chance of a mistake or that two guys with the same name or something, but it was that. Whatever motor is operator happened, in most cases, the motorman would be assigned to a motor, and that would be his motor to look out for every day. And he also had to look out for the equipment on his motor, that it was functioning properly, and if the brakes were adequate to stop the train when it needed to be, if there was any problem showed up with the motor, he reported that in, or then you would have him either take a spare motor, or you would have to have a mechanics work on the motor, do whatever was needed to be done to get it back into service as quickly as possible. But that was when a motorman's job was to see that his motor was kept in running condition and safe to operate at all times.
As a rough estimate, how many motors would be active on any given shift? Did it vary by day, afternoon, and midnight? Was it the same all the time?
Well, each shift there was pretty much a certain amount of certain number of trains that would be operating each day, because again, the number of haulage trains geared to the production age. You need so many trains to get out so many tons of ore each shift, and that's pretty much to a certain number of trains would have to be running quite continuously as fast as you could be loading it there. And keep them going, so that the main thing was to keep the skip going, and you would keep, the longer you could keep loaded cars on the dump side, you were a little bit ahead there, so that there was any time that the skip stops, that ton's lost, because you can't, the skip can only make a given number of trips up and down the shaft in 8 hours, and if any time that the skip is stopped because there's no dirt, that's a loss you can't make up.
Now, on these on the tonnage production expectations per shift, was there a tonnage goal set for each shift, and incentives that were given if that tonnage was met, and sanctions given if the tonnage was not met?
Well, no, there was a little bit of pride in people's work. And there were times when there was a need for a certain number of cars per shift, and if I'm not mistaken, one of the records for, I forget now what the record was, but if somebody would break a record and then the next shift was looking for all the dirt they could get to see if they could better that by one car. So there was a little bit of a time when you knew there was a lot of dirt available, if there was a chance to break somebody's record by one car, well, that's you're even tied it where you took those opportunities. And even among the motor crew themselves were pretty much competitive with other shifts too, because they always felt that as a motor crew, they were just as good as the next guy too, if not a little bit better. So I say, one of the things about working on the ground, there was a little bit of competition in there, which was quite good, because it was showed people had some pride in their work too. But there was a certain, in order to get I don't wrist off hand to use a figure, but there was a time when I forget, I was in the neighborhood of 2,500 tons a shift or something like that. And if you get sometime, if you get 3,000 tons, they really had a good day. The skip was limited to, there were 14 ton skips, and if you would keep that thing going, there was a maximum number of skips there that trips that skip can make. It used to take something like about 2.5 minutes from say down at the 12th level to the dump up on surface up there, so that your maximum tonnage was per shift was controlled by that factor, the number of trips that the skips could make in there. And one time I think it was the last day of the year at the Matter where we came within four or five skips, I believe it was, of the maximum we broke the record, and it was never was broken after that, because it, well, the thing that kept it from getting the last couple of skips there was because the blew a fuse on the crusher inside on 7 level, and the crusher shut down, so they would. That meant the last few skips, but even the super was kind of concerned that something might happen when you push it to the limit like that. So I forget now, it was 300 and some skips anyway, and that never was exceeded after that.
And that happened on one of your shifts?
Yeah, on our shift, yeah. So that was part of that fact. Otherwise, I wouldn't have mentioned it.
Now, was there, was the...
It's off the record something.
Now, let's go back and pick up some of the terminology that we didn't talk about, and I'm sure that more will come up as we go along, but I'm just going to start with my list, and if something seems out of order or you can define it a little in a little better order than I have here, that's fine. First of all, some of the first things that came up were contracts and contract mining. Can you tell me, contract miners were employed by Cleveland Cliffs and paid a basic rate plus an incentive? Is that how that worked?
Yeah, they had what they call miners' company account. They were guaranteed a minimum daily scale if their contracts, if they couldn't. Condition was such that they couldn't make much on their incentive portion. There were times when various things would happen there that they couldn't actually do contract work, and they had to do other things so that they were guaranteed a minimum scale as a part of their contract. But the contract was figured in a number of ways, depending on what your contract was. If you were advancing a raise, it would be called either a naked raise, which was, as it implies, there was no liner or support in it, or a crib raise, and that was, you put in the crib and you were paid a rate to so much per foot for advancing the raise, hitting of the raise. Driving adrift would be depends on the size of the drift you are and the material you're using. I say some places where we're using just regular wood timber, if you were the sub-level drifts were, in other words, drifts above the main level were mainly 8-foot drifts, where main level haul drifts were 9 feet, 9 foot high and 9 foot wide at the top portion of the 9 foot cats. Of course, then you had a little bit of rake on the legs, a little wider in the bottom, but this is referred to as a 9-foot drift or an 8-foot drift. And the size of the drift would depend on the rate per foot that you were getting, or if you were drifting in oil, would be one rate, or if you're drifting on in rock, would be a different rate per foot. And on lots of the sub-level drifts that were put in there, depending on the kind of steel or the support that was being used, the size of the drift would vary in height and diameter, and you're paid according to maybe the amount of ground that you were taking out.
And let me stop you just for a second. A sub-level drift meant that it was smaller than a 9-foot or 8-foot, or did it mean that it was below the main level? What's a sub-level?
A sub-level would be above or below. The main level is only referred to the level. The main level is referred to the level, and then what referred to as subs were any drifts that were developed or advanced in between the main levels. The horizontal drifts between, mainly sub-levels are drifts that were put in to develop the ore body. Put in above the main level for developing the ore body.
What is cribbing?
Well, cribbing is mainly cribbing was mainly made from tamarack trees. And they were I don't remember the exact measurements of them, but they were approximately 4 feet. They were maybe a little bit more in length, but they were notched on either end so that you could, they were used to line raises, what we call crib raises. They were mainly put up in areas that were in ore development areas, or where the rock was not in such of a nature that it needed support. And the opening that was made large enough to accommodate the cribbing and the crib raiser we used for the man wave ladder rolls, we call them, and supply raises, and then there will be also raises put up for transferring of ore from one elevation to another, call them ore pass raises, and usually the crib raises were always lined with 3-inch hardwood plank to prevent the cribbing from wearing out, and then as the planks wore out, sometimes they went in and replaced worn out planks in order to keep protect the cribbing from being worn out before the area was mined out.
So tamarack was used for this because of its hardness then?
Well, it was a pretty durable wood, and it was tough, and it didn't rot out very easily. It was one of the things that you had to, with a lot of wood that was underground, depending on the moisture or the air and the temperature condition down there, that a lot of places the wood would rot over a period of time. Most of the wood timber would go rotten down there, but the fungus would grow on them. There'd be all kinds of interesting shapes of fungi that would grow on the wood timber, but tamarack cribbing was a pretty durable stuff for underground. Especially if you got them into a place that was considered to be a kind of a wet area there that lasted for a long, long time.
How is cribbing different from lagging?
Well, cribbing is used to line raises for support mainly the cribbing was made from tamarack, but it was a time when they got into using hardwood cribbing made for, and but that was sod, mainly the sod into square timbers like this, but mainly for just the round cribbing, it was used, tamarack was used until the availability of tamarack began to get scarce, and then there was some very little hybrid cribbing used. But the difference between cribbing and lagging is used to split cedar, and that was used to cover over the back, over the tops of the timbers, to keep anything. You put poles over the timber, and then covered the pole with lagging. That would keep any rock or ore from dribbling through or chunks coming loose, and kept everything up above the timbers.
What's the back?
Well, the back is usually the roof of the grift. The back is the roof of the drift, and then the heading that you're going into is advancing the drift. Is called that the face or the breast. And so you're going into the breast and the drift, you're going into where the area that's going to be drilled to advance the drift. That's called the breast.
That was new territory, new undrilled.
Yeah, if you're driving the drift in there, when you blast out around there, and you took the ore, the rock out, and put in the timber support, so then when you get ready to advance another 4 or 5 or 6 feet, whatever the size of support you're using in there, you just drilled out enough to get another set of supports in there, and that which is always called the face or the breast is where the drilling was done to advance the drift. Or even up in the range, it's up in the so wherever we're gonna do the drilling, we always refer to that as up in the breast.
Can you define drifting and stoping? I think you maybe just did define drifting, but what are the two, drifting and stoping, and what's the difference between the two?
Well, mainly drifting is little tunnels you drove in there. Some would be most drifting was areas where you advanced area big enough to work, and that usually all that was supported, but most of the drifting is horizontal tunnel that access to the ore the way you want to mine, and then also they had what they call dog drifts, or small access, and sometimes working around a stope area or from one drift to another, connecting safety output from one main drift, from one work area to another, you have a naked drift or a dog drift in there. It's just a small, just big enough for a person to get through. Sometimes you could stand up in it, sometimes you had a crawl through. But that's just a small drift, but a stope is where the ore is being mined out. And after you get an opening up into an ore body, from mainly you start from putting up a raise, and then you would of course there are various methods of taking out ore, but the one that I'm most familiar with is where they were using some bench stoping and sub-low caving and drilling from some sub levels, and where you pull up a raise and you start enlarge the raise and open it up big enough so that the ore, that you can start blasting into that raise, and the more you keep blasting in all around the edge of the raise or into that raise, and then you keep retreating down the drift, and you keep the stope is the void that's being made as the ore is taken out, and and when you're stoping is you're removing the ore. And creating the scope, as you open up a system of undercutting a certain amount of the ore body, well, then it begins to cave by itself. But it's still a scope, but the ore keeps, by its own weight, keeps dropping away and crushing itself, and it keeps coming down. You keep removing it from underneath there.
Is that what sub-level caving is?
That's sub-level caving. One of the early methods was the slice mining, where they get an up off of a raise, and they would drive a drift in, and then when they get to the end of the ore body in there, they would what they call cover down, they would cover the floor of the drift in there, then they would blast that old drift down. And they went alongside of that, and they drive another one in there, and they get the oil out of that, and they blast that one down, and they keep a matting in there to keep rock from when they get the area around the raise mined out there, then you would drop down about maybe 10 or 12 feet, and then they drive another 8 foot distance underneath there, and under what you had above, and then that's the stuff that's up above there is a matting to keep rock and from contaminating the ore. As you're coming down, you're just taking out the ore, and then that pulls the rock and stuff back. That was the old slice mining system. But mainly for the mine got into big big production demands, or the fastest and the best way to getting it out was by sub-level caving and the stopes, and it was a safer, much safer way than stoping was. Where you have bench stopes and different levels, you would keep up doing your drill from around the edge of from the bench around the edge of these openings around the rail, and to keep it retreating back. And there was a considerable amount of hazard involved there as compared to just regular sub-level caving.
What did the bench and bench stoping look like? What exactly did the bench refer to?
Well, you had a start off with a naked raise, and then you go up to your cone that out from down below, what they call coning. You drill a bunch of holes around from the bottom of the raise there, and of course you would have, depending on the height of the ore you had there, you would have up about 15 or 20 feet, and you'd with a little naked drift there, and you go to the rays to connect up a number of these raises, and then you would get up on the top, just up there, then you blast up the top part out, and you come down below to the next one down below, then you blast that out so that you never undermine yourself. You always keep the bench would all be taken down from down below after, but when you got the opening big enough around the rays, if you work from a kind of a bench there, blasted off a piece of the wall there that you were leaving a little arch so that you had something to work in underneath without you not out in the open, and you worked off of that little bench and that arch you had left up there, you could build up into that and you'd blast that down in there. And when you got the top part down, then you go down onto the sub-level below that, and you do the same thing there, and you keep taking it back.
Okay.
Another method of stoping that was from long-haul drilling, where you drove in two or three drifts, And then you connect it up on the end there and put up a couple of rays, and then you start blasting up, and you long hole drilling. Some of these just you drill 40, 50 foot holes off in a fan all around the sides and the bottom, each side of this, and up there probably at around the hole between each set, which would be probably you'd have about every 4 or 5 feet that you drill around the drill around the hole, but each set that you would rig up on each set and drill around the hole, and you blast those long holes and into the slope, but you get a lot of big chunks that way. In some places I fuck with hard anyway, trying to get those chunks down through the rays down below in the bottom there was a kind of a tough situation there sometimes. They wouldn't come down close enough where you could drill them. You try what we call bombs and putting up sticks of dynamite, put long poles together and poke them up there and get some dynamite up on the edge of the chunk there someplace and see if you could knock enough of it down to really come down where you could do something with it. So,
without taking the rays down with it, right?
Yeah.
So dynamiting was done partly to open up the new areas in the drifts, but also partly to blast those big chunks loose in the raises as well.
Yeah.
You remember any...
When you refer to blasting chunks in a razor, you know, most of the time it was you're talking when you're stoping or undercutting or caving is you're blasting the ore down and you take it out through mill razors on the bottom, the razors that have been coned, and then as they're at regular intervals that you had so that you would number the razors in the drift. And somewhat control the extraction of the ore by the number of mills that you're pulling from so much out of there, and control it by the number of mills, the mill numbers, and these mills were put up from the transfer drift over there where you would scrape from, and these mills would be combed out or fanned out funnel shaped so that they would draw the ore down to the opening to get it into the transfer drift, or sometimes they couldn't come all the way down there, so then it would be up, that's what we'd call, what we use, fish poles, and put a dynamite bomb up on the end of that thing, and then place it up in there in a place where you figure you could be effective in breaking the chunk or breaking some pieces off so it would come down a little bit closer.
This is Dewey Tippett's interview on April 24th, 1994, tape number 2, side number 2. Let's talk for a minute about long hole drilling and the different methods of blasting that they had.
Well, the first long hole drilling that they were using as drilling from drilling subs or from sub caving, sub level caving, with they used big sticks of dynamite. They were what we call a 2x24s, 2-foot-long sticks of dynamite. And you do a certain number of sticks depending on the length of the hole, and you always leave a collar up there so that you didn't blast the hole all the way down to the side of the drift. You left some solid ground around the drift there to protect the drift down there. You just blast down so close to the drift. And then they began to replace the dynamite with use a stick of dynamite for a primer, and then using ammonium nitrate and fuel oil as a blasting agent in there was and those were charged with the air and to force the ammonium nitrate up into the holes and use a long plastic hose up there that would carry the ammonium nitrate up into the holes, and you just as it the hole filled up, you gradually retreated with your plastic hose, and you had a kind of a tank there that you put the nitrate in, and then had air pressure connected to the tank that would force the nitrate up through into the hole, and you grounded the equipment that you were charging up with the ammonium nitrate because the static electricity was the nitrate being forced up passing through the plastic tube would make static electricity. So that would ground that to be this equipment to prevent any static electricity from igniting a premature blast on it. So, but. A lot of that system is used even now in the open pits.
Now, do you remember, or would you be willing to talk about any close calls that you had, or that anybody that you were working with on the same shift had, and any details about it?
Well, close calls I had. I guess some I could hardly recall. There have been a number of them, and I think by the grace of God I'm still here. But it's several times that almost walked into a blasting situation. But I'd really rather not say too much about them, but I guess anybody who spent any amount of time working under underground mines has had a situation where they've had close calls.
Do you remember any like inside jokes that the miners had? I mean, were there words or phrases that would be used to tease people, or that were kind of like running practical jokes that people had, or, I mean, other than the terminology that was used just for mining, do you remember any particular kinds of situations like that were pretty funny?
Well, I guess there was a lot of things there that I remember one time when the Matador was filling up with water, and we were had to be down there putting in some, before the pump houses were completed, had to put in some auxiliary pumps there to control the influx of water. One guy was down there standing on the side of the trench there and with his hand in his pockets, and the master mechanic came down that was in charge of installing the pumps, and he looked at this guy and he greeted him with a couple of off-color words, and he said, "Don't you stand there or do something. Whistle, dance, or sing, but don't you stand there." But I won't reveal the name because that one of those guys is still living. And there was two brothers that were contract mining, and there were days when they were still using wood timber, and If the timber hoist would haul it, hoist up a couple of trucks of timber, they'd go through the pile and they look for the smallest timber that they could put up. And he says, how come you keep looking through the pile to find the smallest stuff? He said, you never see big timber on the do bill. So he said, you get the same pay for putting up small stuff as it is for the big stuff, and the small stuff easier to handle and quicker.
So much for the well-renowned work ethic we've heard so much about. Do bills. Tell me about do bills. What are they?
Well, it was a statement of wages due when we used to, or the time when we used to get them. Maybe two or three days before we got our paychecks there, we would have a due bill there that was a statement of the wages that were due. And any, if you were contract mining, it was the number of hours you had, the number of hours you worked for that half. We were paid twice a month if we had the first half and second half. Sometimes you have big halves and small halves, but a pay period was always referred to as a half if you were mining, and this due bill was a statement of your gross earnings, and then it would indicate on there what was deducted for federal and state income taxes, and if you had any supplies that you had to pay for. And if any deductions for charitable organizations such as what do they call it, the community?
United Way,
and such things as that taken off, or then if you had a deduction for. Maybe for savings bonds, for your savings and stuff like that, that would be a statement of what your check amount was going to be, what your gross earnings were, and then what your statement as to what your take-home pay was going to be. So
that would be the equivalent of a present-day pay stub that's usually attached to the check?
That's right. And some of the guys that when they got their due bill prior to when we used to get the due bills prior to payday was the guys that like to have a little money on the side for tavern money would add some things onto their due bill there that were farces, just so that when they took their check home, they would cash the check before they went home, but they would show their wife what their excuse would be. I had to pay so much for cage rides, or I dropped the tugger down the rails and broke it and I had to pay for that. So.
Did they get away with that?
Well, some did they get away with it pretty well. You see, they claimed their wife didn't challenge them, I guess, or they weren't challenged on the. They were just satisfied to settle for what the take-home pay was. So.
What was the take-home pay approximately? Say during the 50s, what would a half?
Well, during the time when I was mining. First started mining anyway. I didn't mine for too many years before I went bossing, but if you had a with just a normal deductions for taxes and so on, if for a half a month's pay, when you took home a check for $100, you had a check that was $100, you had a pretty good payday. And I say it's. Lots of guys don't have to work too many hours these days to make what we had for 2 weeks pay. But it went a long way. We made payments on houses, and we had families to support, and we managed to pick up an old car once in a while, and we lived decently.
On the due bills, what were the kinds of supplies that the miners would have to pay for? I mean, other than dropping a tugger down the
there were things that you would get from the warehouse there one time, if I'm not mistaken, like you, way back you could buy, you know, if you needed gloves or something like that, you would get a pretty cheap buying through the company, and it was, there was some other thing that you would get that you could buy through the company that was cheaper than getting them on somewhere else, you know. But most of the time, guys' gloves were something you go through quite rapidly anyway, so they didn't, pair of gloves didn't last too long on there, you know. So, of course, not that you were wearing out a pair every day or something like that there, but if somebody's need a pair of gloves on short notice, they just go to the warehouse and you get them. So.
I forgot what I was going to ask you. Oh, were you ever paid in iron coins or scrip during the time that you worked for Cleveland Cliffs?
No. The early days, I guess, none of my family that I was ever aware of that I knew of that was ever paid in iron scrip. I don't recall any of that. It was only articles that I've read about it from different times.
Do you remember whether there were ever, in addition to gloves and things like that you could get for use during your job, were there ever any surplus supplies or things like that the miners would be allowed to purchase from the company? And if so, did you ever do that? And what kinds of things would you have purchased?
Well, not offhand, I don't recall. I don't know if there was a time when they could get the boots from or not, the rubber boots and that, the hard toe boots. I don't remember now too much about some of that stuff they could get.
You don't have to answer this question if you don't want to, but do you remember on your first day of going underground what that felt like, knowing what your father's first day underground was like?
Well, it never bothered me. I felt pretty much at ease going down there. In fact, when I decided that I was going to go to work in the mine, I was kind of looking forward to going to work there. The only thing I was still living home when I started work at the mine, and my mother asked me not to take my mining gloves to the mine before I went to work. And she said, "We never go to work, take them with you," because that's what my father did. He took his clothes to the mine the day before, and then so he went out to haul them, and then after he was killed on the first day. So I honored her request there, but I mean, other than that, it didn't bother me about going to work on the mine. I never had any fear of working in the mine.
Was there ever a time when you were working that there was a strike or a layoff? And I'm not so interested in the circumstances of the strike or the layoff as what you did to make ends meet during that time.
Well, the only strike I was in that affected me was in the fall of 1949. There we had mine went on strike on the 1st of October, and it was out until the middle of November. But well, we got along all right. We went out and cut pulp and spruce boughs for my father-in-law, and cut pulp up on his property there for him. So that kept us busy until the mine started back to work again. Of course, when the mine started back to work was around the 14th of November or the 15th of November or something like that. So we called in, we had wood to get out of the wood, so we stayed out a couple more days so we wouldn't miss the first day of the deer season. But after that, before the next strike or contract was up for renewal there while in the negotiation. By that time I was on as a salaried supervisor, so that from then on the rest of my mining career, I never was out of work. I was very fortunate in that respect.
Now, there was a benefit that you took advantage of, namely being able to take a trip on an ore boat. Can you describe how that was offered to employees and how people were chosen to do that and what that experience was like?
Well, the salaried employees were given an opportunity during the shipping season there to take a trip on one of the oil boats, and it was there were so many logs from each property each shipping season there to take a trip on an oil boat, and it was mainly when the time for a trip came up, you could have you might end up with a trip that only go down as far as Algoma Steel at the Sioux Locks and back to Marquette, when that was your trip. But there was some trips were pretty good, but it was, the trip was nice. You were on there as a passenger, you were well fed, and you could pretty much visit what you wanted to go on the ship. It was pretty much a very nice trip, and you were allowed to take have one guest with you, mainly men that went on a trip took their spouse along, or you could take one member of your family with you. Because of sleeping quarters there, where you could take your wife or you could take a son or somebody along and the trip some trips would last 3 or 4 days, and some trips lasted maybe 10 or 12 days. Usually when you made a trip, it would probably be about maybe 5 or 6 years or more before another opportunity would come along, because each one of the salaried employees on the properties would be given the opportunity, if they wanted to take a trip, one is what you would get, but you waited till the others had their turn before they came around to you again. So I was lucky enough to have two.
Mm-hmm. Did they do that kind of like in the order that you signed up, or did they do it, everybody signed up and then they drew lots, or how did they choose?
Well, I don't know how they actually did it, but it was somewhat in your seniority or some such thing of that. I guess the older employees had the first opportunities to get those trips, and then in the later years, the company sold their fleet of oil vessels, and they don't have it anymore. So.
Do you remember any particularly colorful characters that you worked with? For whatever reason, they might be colorful, or people that you particularly admired or respected, and why?
Oh, we had some pretty good. We had some real characters that were. They were good workers and everything, but they were comical people. And we had one old gentleman there that Benny Nelson, and he wasn't always so much the story he told, but the way he could tell it. And I remember one time this was a time of when blue bills were issued 2 or 3 days before payday, eh? So he had was around the middle of November, first half of November, and he got his blue bill, and the mining captain or superintendent used to make periodic trips to the mine and visit the contracts, and this guy was, well, Benny was in a contract, and he always had a story to tell, or some joke, some good humor thing. He was always in a good mood. So when the superintendent came in, he sat down on the side of the drift there in the dock, and then hung his head. And the super said, "What's the matter, Ben?" He said, "Boy, you guys sure did me dirty this time," he said. And I said, "I don't know how I can go home and face my family." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, when the blue bill came out, we had so much money coming." And he said, "Yesterday when I picked up my check, they made a mistake figuring the contract, and I don't have that kind of money coming." And he said, "When I got my blue bill, I went home and told the family we got money this time." And he had a big family, and he said, "We're going to have turkey for Thanksgiving." He said, "How am I going to go home now and tell them that we're going to have chickadees and hazelnuts?" I took care of the superintendent. And he could say those things with a straight face too, so it's a but he used to come up with a number of pretty good stories there, but there's some that I would rather not repeat here too, but he was pretty good. He said his partner look was been in the service and came back from service and started work underground again, and he got working partners with Denny for a while, and they were up putting up a raise, and so when his partner came down out of the raise, he had a bunch of stuff he was packing down, and wet bits and the other stuff he had there, and he said, boy, he come down out of that raise like a paratrooper, he said, with all the junk he had on him. They say it wasn't always so much the story, but the way he could tell it is. But there were a number of pretty good characters we had down there. But there was some of them. There was some stories there that were pretty good, but pretty much left as as unrepeated stories. I think it's a. Some of them went a little bit off color in order for not to hurt anybody's feelings or something, have something just to get back with, just not to leave them saying.
Were there any practical jokes that were routinely played on the new guys when they came?
Oh, yeah, there was. You hang your jacket up there someplace. If you took the jacket off to work and you find it nailed to the timber or something like that, and some of the guys that they come down when they're gonna blast, they blast at lunchtime, dinner time, and they come down and sit on a plank and a couple blocks of wood for a bench there by the called the kingpin at the switch going into a crosscut, so they would. Come down there where they would have the fresh air while the smoke was going out, they would sit up and let this fresh air coming down the main line. And they had their lunch there, then they'd hang up their buckets on a nail, and there's not a time when they're going into workplace, they'd hang up their bucket there, and then when they come down dinner time, they pick it up and eat. And sometimes they come down at quitting time, and they're going to be in a hurry to catch the cage, and they'd go to pick up their bucket, they'd find it was nailed to the bench or something like that. Those are some of the things where they get guys in the cage and they'd be kicking or something like that, and there'd be 35 men on the cage and they're all crammed in there pretty tight, so you never know who was doing the kicking, but you could suspect who they were. But we had one guy on there, they called him Smitchy, and he couldn't stand the fuzz on the peach. So they wait till they get him in the cage, and somebody reach over behind him and they stick a peach over in front of his face, and the poor guy had to take it to look at the peach to drive him nuts, and he just had no way to go and nothing he could do. Usually would be a boss would ride on each deck with the men to kind of keep a little bit of order there, but there was time when you couldn't nip everything in the bud, but they pulled some tricks on the guy every once in a while.
Lunch buckets. There's been a lot of information out there about lunch buckets and different things like that. During the time that you worked, was there a typical type of lunch bucket, and what did most of the guys take for lunch?
Well, they just, I don't know, pretty much the, most guys had a pretty much just lunch buckets as we see them today, I guess. But in sandwiches and stuff like that there, because they, during the time that I started work in the mine work on the ground way, you had a 20 minutes lunch time was a part of your negotiated contract, and you had eaten time on the job, and most guys would, if you're mining, you didn't take any special time. There was no special time to eat. You would eat whenever you want. If you went on, some guys would go on the ground and see them on the ground, and they get inside and they sit down and they'd eat the lunch right away. But most of the time, the miners would would go into their place and they would work, and then if they would be blasted by around noon time, and then be sometime before the end of the shift there, while they would work until they blast, and then they would eat while the smoke was going out, and then as soon as they get done eating, and the place pretty well cleared out, they go back and they work. And it was, when you're working on an incentive basis, way, the more time you could save, and you could keep working on your contract heading, where you're making more money that way. So, but otherwise, guys, that people that were just the scrapermen or maintenance people and that there, they just usually around, would get around and maybe at 12 o'clock, well, then they would drop what they're doing and sit down and have their lunch. But years ago, before the miners used to work something like 10 hour days or that there, they would come up from underground and eat. That would be during the time before they went down to 8 hour shifts and had union representation there, but lots of the miners they would carry a lunch bucket. And they would come up from underground, and especially up in North Lake, they used to let the school out at about 11:30, and then the kids would be carry lunches up to the Section 6 and Lloyd and what they were, those days it was called, and Lloyd and the Morris, they were, in those days they were called number one and number two, and the miners would come up from underground at noontime and have their lunch, and then they would be brought hot lunches in these buckets there. The kids would all carry lunches up for the guys. Of course, the guys that traveled from town or something like that there, where they had carried these regular sandwiches, but after these people had hot meals and sometimes a pasty in there or a hot peel.
And you would have been how old when this was done with these miners and those two mines?
Well, I can remember when I was going to grade school there, because sometimes when we go up to North Lake, especially in the summertime, and playing with kids up there, that the kids had to be home. Well, I got to be home, right at home, and carry dinners. And sometimes if an older person working the mine that didn't have any kids at home, they'd have some of the neighbors' kids would carry the lunches up there for them, carry the dinners. So.
We have about 2 minutes left on the tape. Is there anything that I should have asked you about that I didn't, or anything we'd like to add? We didn't talk about the Anderson dog drift, if you want to add that or anything else.
Well, that Anderson dog drift there was usually, if you're driving a dog drift there, that's a small naked drift just for access from one, probably a raise or a drift to another, and it's just a narrow, a small passageway, and it's not, you don't get paid for the size, you get paid for the length of it. And so in some of these bench slopes in there, where they had little connecting dog drifts up there, and they had a drift that you could stand up in there, and Cap Anderson would come in and said, this is the kind of a contract I like, where you got Cap Anderson dog drifts in there. So they're big enough for Cap Anderson to fit in there. He was about 6'6" and weighed about 250 pounds, I would imagine. He was a big man anyway, but he needed room, but he used to enjoy that if he didn't have to get down on his hands and knees and crawl.
Mm-hmm. Or risk getting stuck.